This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to another edition of the Paranormal Podcast, and here we are just on the cusp of Halloween. So happy Halloween to everybody out there. And again, thanks so much. We've gotten some fantastic reviews on iTunes. That's really picking up the downloads for this month. Boy, we're almost at the end of the month, and we're going to far exceed any month we've ever had. So we appreciate that. And just hope you're having a good time with all the different topics. We're really trying to mix it up. And speaking of mixing it up, we've got something that's a little bit different for you tonight. I'm joined by Ken Thomas. He is the co-editor of the new book, Secret and Suppressed, Banned Ideas and Hidden History into the 21st Century. And if you are a conspiracy fan, this is the book to have, because there's everything from A to Z, everything from soup to nuts. Ken, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Jim, thanks for having me.
Now, maybe we could talk a little bit about the history of the secret and suppressed nameplate and how that name came about.
Okay.
And the original edition and a little bit about what this edition adds to the legacy.
Okay, yeah, that's very interesting, because actually the title of the book is about as colorful as everything that's inside the book. Secret and Suppressed, the original volume of Secret and Suppressed, came out in the early 90s, and it was edited by my old writing partner, Jim Keith. And it was an anthology of various kinds of conspiracy ideas that kind of percolate in this, what I call the parapolitical underground, which is, you know, where kind of all the fringe elements discuss, you know, various ideas that are kind of off the beaten path. And Keith assembled them in this one book, and it became a very popular thing, to the extent, actually, that I think it was one of the foundations of the whole pop culture phenomenon of conspiracies, X-Files. Chris Carter actually acknowledged that the book was a big influence on the creation of the X-Files, you know, and like the Mel Gibson conspiracy theory movie and the Lone Gunman and thing. That was, you know, if you can flash back to the early 90s, that was not as big a phenomenon as it was until Jim Keith came along with the original volume of Secret and Suppressed.
You know, it's kind of interesting that the author of the original book has unfortunately passed away, and even his death lent some grist for the conspiracy mill, didn't it?
That's quite correct, yes. And in fact, we kind of lay that out a little bit in the introduction to this new volume of Secret and Suppressed, what happened to Jim. Jim and I actually went on to write another pretty well-known book in this whole parapolitical underground called The Octopus. We were the co-authors of this book that was about a writer named Danny Casolaro, who was killed in the process of researching this kind of global cabal known as The Octopus. And it was shortly after that that Keith died under very odd circumstances. He was at the Burning Man Festival in Nevada.
Sure.
He suffered a knee injury. And in the long run, that knee injury got him into the hospital where he died officially of a pulmonary embolism. But during that whole period, there was a suspension in this country of surgeries to the knee, because people were turning up, were dying because they were going in for knee surgeries. And it all had to do with cartilage that had been supplied to people performing this operation that were tainted with Clostridium bacteria, which was precisely something that Keith had written about to some extent earlier, about CIA stockpiles of this mysterious bacteria. So, there was no full investigation. The way these things happen is the official story came in, pulmonary embolism, but here we have this strange connection to Clostridium that was made even more strange by the death shortly thereafter of Ron Bonds, the man who published most of Jim Keith's books. Bonds was the head of Illuminate Press, which was a big underground small book publisher. And he died after going to an El Azteca restaurant and getting poisoned by Clostridium bacteria. And then finally, when they traced what was going wrong with all of these knee surgeries, they traced it actually to a tissue bank near Atlanta, Georgia, which is where Ron Bonds lived. So you have a whole network of very, you know, curious little coincidences that really put the Keith death and Bond's death into the whole strange milieu that we'd always written about.
You know, it's interesting. I was going through and, you know, I kind of have paid attention to conspiracy theories.
Shame on you.
But not enough, apparently, because I guess my point here is that, you know, probably more than the average person. But there was a lot of things I'd never heard of before. And the one was, I guess, kind of the grandmother of the movement. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name right.
May Brussel.
May Brussel. Okay. And yeah. I was trying to be fancy there.
you can remember May's name by what happened to her followers after she died. They broke into to two different camps, and people refer to them as the Brussels sprouts.
So, yeah, well, tell us a little bit about her.
She was the maven of conspiracy theory writing. She basically kind of almost started the whole phenom. And in the book, we have an interview with her conducted by Paul Kressner, who was a guy who published in the 60s and the 70s, published a newsletter called The Realist, which was, you know, like the forerunner of all the kind of conspiracy newsletters that came after it. Paul, of course, is a kind of a comedian, stand-up guy, and his whole take on it is kind of funny. But he knew May, and he goes in this rather long interview, kind of really gets into the mind of May Brussel, who was like a newspaper clipper. You know, she would find different little bits of information in, you know, and she read dozens of newspapers a day, and she'd clip them all, and she'd kind of arrange all the information to see if she could shake down some kind of interesting angle or something to look at something in a particular way that revealed things that weren't being presented like straightforward into the newspapers. You know, like there was a plane crash of a congressman who was involved in some kind of investigation. She would put that down, and then she would notice also that the space shuttle had a trajectory over that very area where that plane came down. So she would put those together and suggest that, you know, maybe there was some kind of, you know, weapon or something that helped usher this congressman into the hereafter. So, the classically cast, again, I refer you back to the Mel Gibson movie. We actually have a cult conspiracy theory. We have a cab driver basically playing the May Brussel role. And it's the classic kind of stereotype almost of the conspiracy writer, the kind of obsessed person who's kind of looking for details. But May was, you know, she won the George Selvis Award for journalism. I mean, she was really kind of in her way, a mainstream person as well. So,
well, what was amazing, I was fascinated, by the way, and we're talking, I think the one interview is from the late 70s.
She died in 88, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing was is that this is pre-computer, so she had hand clippings from newspapers, I guess, from all over the world. She had this elaborate system of cross-indexing and connecting one thing to the other, and I just thought, she would have had a lot of fun in the Internet age.
She was, in fact, the model, almost, of the Internet, the walking, talking Internet. In fact, when the Internet first started happening, you would see these cartoons, you know, what's on the Internet, you know, the information superhighway, and there'd always be a little sign that says conspiracy theorists that way, because it was a foundation, kind of a foundation, a model of that kind of communication, you know, where the metaphor I use is the bulletin board, because I've got to do it myself. If I find information, I just put it on the bulletin board. If I find something that should go with it, I put that on the bulletin and make little clusters of information, which is basically kind of what the Internet was.
Well, when you talk about conspiracy theory, one of the first signposts up ahead would be the Illuminati, and you certainly cover that in this text. Give us kind of a thumbnail of some of the discussions of the Illuminati in Secret and Suppressed 2.
Yeah, actually, I think one of the highlights of this book is that it contains the last writing of another great conspiracy writer, named Robert Anton Wilson, whose famous satirical work was the Illuminatus Trilogy, which came out in the mid-70s, that kind of carried on this tradition of first off examining reality for its underlying currents, but at the same time kind of seeing it all also as a satire and having some humor to it. So he had this whole thing, part of his Illuminatus book, which was an examination of how this secret society, which people, you know, trace back to ancient Egypt, but you know, how it kind of affected modern affairs and affected like the narrative of the novel. And one of the characters in this, one of the historically real characters in the Illuminatus was Adam Weishaupt, who was one of the founders of what we know truly as the true Illuminati in Bavaria during the time of the American Revolution. Now, Wilson's take on it was a lot of different things. So one of them was that, you know, that Adam Weishaupt actually traveled to America and assassinated George Washington and took his place, and it's actually his.
Yeah, his, I couldn't. His, yeah, his when I read that, I said, "Say what? Where did that come from?"
Yeah, so it's all a kind of, well, you know, the Illuminati was a real secret society. It was actually at the time a trend to create secret societies, a fashionable thing to do. It was all a product of the Enlightenment. These are people, you know, who had progressive social ideas, but they were living in an age where, like, the Catholic Church dominated large portions of the culture. It was a very authoritative, kind of top-down bureaucratic management style of the culture at the time. So they had to circulate their ideas in an underground, in a secret way, you know. So even today, you get, like, right-wing Christian groups who characterize the Illuminati as this evil, the evil forces of Satan working against the good Christian world. In reality and in history, it's kind of, you know, forward-thinking people doing their best to sneak progressive ideas onto a backward culture. So again, we have Robert Anton Wilson, you know, who's very famous, very popular. I'm sure many of your listeners know who he was. But his last writing at all, you know, he died last year, is about Adam Weishaupt. And we have that essay in there. And we also have an excerpt from Weishaupt's own book, Diogenes Lamp, in there. So, and there is a Knights Templar kind of deconstruction of Weishaupt's history. So there's a whole section that really kind of gets into this and really tells you a lot more about that whole, what, you know, Weishaupt and the Illuminati is all about.
Also in that section of the book, there's a discussion of occult Nashville. Now, when I think of Nashville, I think of rhinestone suits and guitars. but apparently Jim Mars thinks of something else.
That's right. Now, Jim Mars, of course, have you had Jim Mars on your show?
No, but we would like to do that.
Well, he would be a great guest. His book, his famous, he's written a lot of books, and he's one of the great conspiracy writers. He's a down-home Texas guy, real plain-speaking guy, and he's written about some great stuff. But his known book to Kennedy assassination researchers is called Crossfire, and it comprised one half of what Oliver Stone depended on when he created the JFK movie. Mm-hmm. So Jim Mars is a real mainstream expert on the Kennedy assassination. And in this particular article, he kind of goes through the symbolism that's kind of coded into areas around Nashville that reflect a kind of occult underpinnings. And this is another current in the book, in the Seeking the Press book. There's another article that goes into the cults in Santa Cruz involving Tuesday Weld and things like that.
Yeah, that was an interesting one as well. Yes. Now, we move on from that to parascience, and here the first one that caught my eye, and there's a chapter obviously that's deep into your expertise, but the secret history of NASA. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is Michael Barra, who is connected in his research with Richard Hoagland, another famous mm-hmm. person,
of course,
on the talk show, parapolitical talk show circuit. It all involves how, and it connects really up to this occult Nashville business, about how occult symbolism is kind of used by NASA and has been encoded in various aspects of the space program. Feral House, the publishers of Seeking the Press, too, actually also recently published, I believe the title of it is Dark Moon, which has a lot more of this. It's not, as you might expect, we didn't land on the moon kind of conspiracy crazy stuff.
Right.
It's more
right.
about, seriously, about how occult symbolism is intertwined in the way NASA organizes space missions and is able to kind of talk in a kind of Kant language that allows them to communicate different things about anomalies on the moon and anomalies on Mars and that kind of thing.
It's absolutely, because you have this clean-cut image, particularly the 60s program, you know, the right stuff, Tom Wolfe and all of that. And then you hear, you know, NASA may be largely populated by wizards to some extent. So it's very interesting.
Wizards, masons, you know, different things like that, yeah.
Now, you're you know, we just recently did a show on Roswell and so forth, and I think it ties in somewhat to your area of expertise. You have a section in that Paris Science portion of the book, Wilhelm Reich, Eisenhower, and the Aliens. Now, we're familiar with Eisenhower and the Aliens, but who was Wilhelm Reich?
Well, it relates to Roswell in that, here's a point that I make in the book, in that a lot of the skeptics community, for instance, will say that everything about Roswell was totally made up by these researchers in the late 80s, that there was, you know, a press release at the time of the Roswell thing that was kind of created in the excitement of the moment and was really describing the Mogul balloons or whatever, and then people just kind of forgot about it until these scurrilous UFO researchers in the 80s came along and yented it all back up and got everybody all excited, and that there was nothing between, you know, the 40s and the 80s about this at all. But the Wilhelm Reich story, which is very long, very interesting, and very complicated, but one of the basic things about it is that we have Reich's testament of traveling through Roswell, New Mexico in 1955 and very precisely looking for the alien presence. Now, Reich was a guy who was a very famous protege of Sigmund Freud, who was kicked out of the Communist Party for being too psychoanalytic and kicked out of the Viennese Psychoanalytic Institute for being too communist, and he was a real I hate to use the word because it's political denotations these days, but he was a maverick. And when he came to America in the 50s, he started experimenting with an energy that he called orgone, which he created devices that kind of collected what he considered an atmospheric energy and an energy that's kind of found in the human body, collected them in these boxes called orgone boxes, and he created a technology in which he could manipulate that energy and put them into these devices that look like cannons called cloudbuster guns. And he took these cloudbusters into Tucson in the 1950s and used them in what he called an interplanetary valley forge. He had fights with UFOs using orgone energy and cloudbuster guns in the deserts around Tucson. And on the trip to Tucson, he drives through Roswell. And it's clear in his last book, which is very hard to find, and this is one of the things about parapolitical research. There is so much kind of samizdat literature and hard-to-find literature. And Reich's last book, which is called Contact with Space, is only available to people who can find somebody who knows somebody that might Xerox it for them and that kind of thing. But if you can find Reich's last book, you can see this report. That he, and he knows. And this is 1955. This is like a decade after the original Roswell crash. But he knows about what's going on there. So to say, as the skeptics do, that this was nothing, that it's all kind of a creation or blown out of proportion by latter-day UFO researchers, is just like proven wrong by this story. And really, that's just that section of the book, that is just one small dimension of what needs to be said about Reich and Eisenhower and that whole period. And it's really one of the lost stories of the UFO lore. So,
and it seems as though that was a period of time that was very chock full of a lot of intrigue. You had that, then that rolls into the role of people like Wernher von Braun, who, there might not be a direct connection necessarily, but who was key in the development of the American space program and the American rocketry program Nazi ties and so forth.
We have a photograph in the book, actually, of Heinrich Himmler attending Wernher von Braun's initiation into the SS. And yeah, you're right. That dovetails into all that's been said about the secret space program. You know, in another book that, of mine called The NASA Nazis and JFK, I run a photograph, actually, of JFK and Wernher von Braun that von Braun talks about in his own memoir. He says, like, right after this photograph was taken, he and JFK had a falling out, had some kind of argument specifically about the propulsion system that we used to get to the moon. Now, von Braun, who has, you know, former Nazi, paperclip Nazi guy, was a rocket scientist, and clearly he was arguing that for the system, you know, to use rocket fuel. And the question becomes then, what was JFK arguing about? You know, what other kind of system did we have? And this goes into the whole moon hoax business about when you see the lander taking off on the moon, you don't really see a rocket blast. And it raises all kinds of very interesting questions. So all that kind of...
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's all touched upon in one form or another in Secret and Suppressed too. One of the things that we have actually that comes up in the Reichstag, one of the other great photographs I think of this book is a photograph of Richard Nixon and Jackie Gleason.
Oh yes, on the golf course.
Yeah, playing golf shortly after supposedly Nixon, who remember was Eisenhower's vice president, took Gleason to see the alien bodies. You know, which Gleason talked about, as Widow talks about, and it's all part of the Lord, that those alien bodies were out there, and Nixon took them out there, then they went and played golf.
A whole new meaning to straight to the moon, Alice.
Exactly.
I could not resist that one.
God, I wish we had you for this book, didn't
you? Thank you. Yeah. The thing you just mentioned it. You said a statement that said you opens up a lot of questions, and in the 3 years of doing this program, and certainly not to the depth and extent that you've surveyed parapolitical study, but just paranormal. The more I do the show, the more questions I have. How do you feel about that statement in your work?
Well, of course, you know, the more Einstein said something about the more you know, the wider the brighter the light, the larger the circumference of darkness. So, yeah, the more you know, the more questions that you have. That prefix, by the way, para, as in parapolitical or paranormal, means to run alongside. And so this is all the information that kind of runs alongside normal reality, normal politics, and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of it, you know. You find, you know, in consensus reality that there's a lot of kind of trimming down, a lot of people living inside reality tunnels and ignoring all the data, all the extra data that's around there. So to me, that's the whole, that's my whole pursuit. That's why I have over 15 books in print on these subjects, is because, you know, so much data gets left out. How can you really reach any conclusions about anything if you don't have, or at least make an attempt to reach out to all the data?
It's interesting. You have an article here in the parascience area on secret weather wars. And I remember seeing an article maybe 15 years ago. It was entitled, and I forget if it was in, I don't know, a radio magazine or something. It said, "Angels Don't Play This Harp." Tell us a little bit about the HARP program and some of the other mysterious manipulations of our weather patterns.
Okay, well, the HARP, well, that's a section written by my good friend Jerry Smith, who wrote a book. He didn't write the book that you mentioned. The book you mentioned was written by, I think, by Nick Bajic, actually. And I'm not quite sure what the full title of Jerry's book is, but it is HARP, which is the High Aerial Array. I forget what HARP stands for. Yeah, that's what that whole section of the book is dedicated to, how the government uses weather technology in its arsenal of national security weapons. You know, it's good, I think, let me check here again, that it follows the Reich thing, because that was another dimension of the Reich story. Reich was the other use of the Cloudbuster gun was for weather manipulation. And in fact, he did get government interest to do that. The Air Force, I think, I don't know if we have the photograph in here, probably not, but the Air Force actually created its own weather engineering device that they officially called the Cloudbuster. So HARP is like that, and HARP and the whole panoply of weather weapons, you know, it's just something that doesn't often get discussed. I mean, never actually gets discussed on the evening news when you talk about weapon systems and all that stuff. They don't, even though enormous resources have been devoted to weather manipulation, it largely gets ignored.
And I know it was a concern, and I may be speaking incorrectly, so if I am, please correct me, but there was concern that there would be efforts to manipulate the ionosphere, I believe it was, and, you know, maybe do some type of irreparable damage to the atmosphere by trying to play God a little too much. I think those were some of the concerns I had read about back in the 90s.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's everybody's kind of reaction to it. You hear all kinds of things in this area. One of them is has to do with contrails or chemtrails, as they're called.
Oh yes, we've heard of that. Yes, definitely.
In the sky, you hear people saying that this is, even though this is just supposedly, you know, condensed air from aircraft. You can really, sometimes when you look up in the sky, you can really see like it's some kind of intended pattern crisscrossing things, and it can't just be random stuff. And you hear people saying that it's chemicals used to keep people stupid.
Well, all you have to do is turn on the television, and you might be inclined to believe them.
Plenty of stupid people out there.
On to a topic, you have a section here. The next section of the book is called The Controllers. Yeah. And something that kind of threw me for a loop was the article on Jim Jones and the People's Temple. Probably most of our audience is familiar in the late 70s in Jonestown, Guyana. There was a massacre where untold hundreds died mass suicide, all kind of spurred along by Jim Jones, and there was a congressman who got killed and so forth when he came down to investigate, and that kind of kicked the whole tragic event off. But according to this, there may have been more to that than just a madman on a mission.
Oh, well, that's absolutely true. You referred to them as suicides, and that's really the kind of the common description. But there's most of those were homicides. Most of those deaths were killings, murder. It was mass murder. It was not really suicide. And Hoogan kind of sets out the case for that in his article. It's actually, if you examine it at all, it's almost an indisputable fact that there may have been some forced suicides, but for the most part, what happened there was mass murder.
And, yeah,
and Jim Hoogan, again, is a mainstream writer. He wrote a great history of covert agency called Spooks.
Yeah. It just, that was something I did not expect to see. And then,
also, I should mention, too, that this has been a dialogue, kind of a dialogue going on. The other person who writes about this, he's not in our book, because Hoogan's piece really is really as complete as you can get on it, but John Judge, who was one of the Brussels sprouts that we talked about earlier, has written extensively about the Jones thing, which happened in 77, late, actually around the time of the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination in late November in 77.
Yeah, it was a tragic event. I was but a child then, but it's something that just, it's one of the things you always remember.
It's counterintuitive in many ways. You know, mass suicide is a very, very rare thing. You know, people should have been asking then, what the heck, and that it's not really suicide. Again, you gotta think of it in terms of murder and also CIA involvement.
Yeah, it was quite a chilling story. And then you go back into the Nazi theme. I mean, there's always been kind of this Boys of Brazil fear out there. I mean, for years after the Second World War ended, there was a theory, you know, is Hitler still alive? And then there was the movie, The Boys from Brazil.
Right.
Laurence Olivier and Gregory Peck.
Well, the section you refer to, Exposing the Nazi International, is one of the things that connects this volume of Secret Express 2 to the first one. When he's referring to the Nazi, Exposing the Nazi International, there was an article in the first one, ostensibly by kind of a whistleblower from the behind-the-scenes camp in South America of rich elite Nazis. And what Joseph Farrell does in that article is kind of analyze the previous article from way back in the early 90s when it was originally published. And, it's difficult for me to give everybody's different takes on these things. I mean, we were talking before about how the Nazis took over the space program. Actually, the whole intelligence network of Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi intelligence network, was overtaken by our own. The foundations of the CIA are all kind of enmeshed in with this with these Nazi elites.
And then, of course, I think, and I'm going to state my bias right up front here in regard to this. You know, when we do this show, we like to bring all things out, positive, negative, whether I personally believe them, I don't. Although I'm a firm believer of the official events, probably like people who are around for the Kennedy assassination, firmly believe there was a lone assassin and that's it. For me, I firmly believe the 9/11 events happened as we were told they happened. I believe it was Al-Qaeda and so forth. But in fairness, no discussion of modern-day conspiracy theory would be complete without referencing the fact there are a lot of people out there that disagree with what I believe.
Okay, well, let me just quote the book. Actually, it's one of the sections. My voice pops in and out of the book. You know, I wrote the introduction, and I wrote the introduction for several pieces, and I wrote my article. At the beginning of the part you're talking about now, the lingering questions about 9/11, I put it this way, because I'm kind of in your camp on this a little bit. Mm-hmm. Many questions linger, of course, concerning the infamous plane disasters of September 11, 2001, almost none of them having to do with the absence of a plane striking the Pentagon or the projection of holographic images of airliners on the trade towers as they were being demolished by explosive charges. And that kind of sums it up. I do believe there are conspiracy questions that involve 9/11. They don't have anything to do with the idea that there was no plane in the Pentagon. I actually went there, talked to all the people that worked in the hotel across from the Pentagon. Everybody saw a plane, you know, to a person. And but at the same time, they also, you know, in fact, the hotel security cameras took video of what happened there. And every one of those persons said, yeah, we saw the plane crash in there. They also said the FBI came out and confiscated all that footage, and it hasn't surfaced since then. So there's an issue. You know, Norman Panetta actually gave testimony to Congress that Dick Cheney ordered a stand down order, not a shoot down order, but a stand down order, so that when the Al Qaeda flown planes were crashing into the trade towers, basically the image in my mind that emerges is that Cheney and Bush and company were saying, hey, this is something we can work with. And even though I don't for a minute believe that that the Bush administration was behind this, or Mossad, or any of those kinds of things, I do believe that there's a certain kind of collusion that goes on there. And there are serious questions that are trackable in the historic record, like the guy Danny Pearl, who was beheaded. What was he investigating when he was beheaded? It was a payoff that was made by the head of the Pakistani Secret Service to Mohammed Atta that came from Western sources. You know, so there are conspiracy issues that need to be discussed seriously. But there's a whole, you know, boatload of garbage out there that tends to obfuscate the issue. Very much like the Kennedy assassination thing, there are people out there that believe that the driver turned around and shot Kennedy. And he didn't. You know, any clear version of the Zapruder film shows that he did not. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't any conspiracy there, you know. So, and in any event, no matter what you believe about 9/11, you have to believe in a conspiracy. If you believe it was Al Qaeda, well, it was obviously a conspiracy by Al Qaeda to do it. So, there are parapolitical dimensions that that need to be looked at. And I make the point again in my introduction to Harry Helms, who's written a much longer treatise on this called Top Secret Tourism, but I make the point that the Kennedy assassination community actually only began to grow in 1966 with the release of Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment. So that was like 3 years from the time Kennedy was killed until a head of steam was beginning to build up about the questions involving that. With 9/11, of course, it was like the next day, there was like a million websites, you know, talking all this stuff. And so you got a big signal-to-noise ratio almost at the beginning.
Now, isn't it true, though, I mean, from everything that I've read in the literature, that let's say, let's not say 9/11, but let's say event X happens. Let's say that it's some kind of political assassination. And let's say that there are nefarious machinations behind the scenes and somebody high in government is involved in it. One way to cover the tracks is to throw out a lot of disinformation and kind of crazy conspiracy theories to kind of mask the real one. Isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And surely you see that's what's going on. You know, that's a whole other dimension of conspiracizing, right, that they would do that kind of thing. But then on the other hand, you know, you do have genuine people. The whole driver did it theory, for instance, was popularized by a guy named Bill Cooper, who was a very serious dissident about particularly involving taxes and the federal government, and who was eventually killed by authorities, by the sheriff's office in Eager, Arizona. And he was wrong about the Kennedy assassination, but it was a kind of a heartfelt dissent that he felt that, you know, crooks and murderers and stuff were in control. So some of it, yes, is deliberately planted misinformation. That's the whole lesson, in fact, behind Area 51. You know, you cannot discuss this big secret military base where all this advanced weaponry is being developed, like the U-2 and the Blackbird and all the stuff. You can't even begin to discuss that without everybody, you know, without this laughter curtain being pulled around you. You're talking about the aliens and UFOs,
right,
and stuff like that.
So exactly.
It serves to discredit the discussion.
And that's something that I always point out, and I've pointed out several times on the show. But, you know, I wonder how many government agents are actually dressed up in alien costumes during Roswell weekend, trying to make everybody who's seriously interested in this kind of thing look like a bunch of crazy. You know.
Well, I'm sure that goes on. And also, but also, it's a subculture that involves a lot of interest. It's entertainment for people. It's kind of a warm and fuzzy connection to, you know, popular culture since the end of World War II. And so I'm not as critical as many people are of every crazy thing that gets said on the UFO circuit. I mean, I know it's a bit of a circus and it's a bit of an entertainment for people. But it's also, and this was true of Bill Cooper, it's also a big billboard to drag people into the discussion one way or another.
That's true. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I don't think, well, I'll ask you. Let's say that I'm a skeptic and I've read your book and I said, how can you possibly believe in everything, Ken Thomas, that's in this book? What would you say to that?
I don't think it requires belief. What I think I'm dealing with is data. What I'm supplying to people is data that challenges various belief systems. You know, when somebody comes to me with a question like that, they've obviously come up against something that goes against their belief system. I can't believe this because I believe that.
Right.
And although I'm not a total relativist. You know, I'm not saying all these things could be true. You know, for instance, there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. You know, the lone nut thing just doesn't work. There's just no way that you can examine any amount of historical research on that topic and come to that conclusion. So, you know, I do believe that there are truths that you can reach if you know the data and you work it and you study it and you try to understand it. You know, that's my whole effort. But I'm not a dogmatist. I'm not trying to push down anybody's throats a particular point of view. But I'm not going to stand still for the kind of the hateful stuff. You see people out there saying that it's all the fault of the Jews, you know, the great Jewish Zionist conspiracy theory. You know, that's nothing but the religious prejudice of, you know, right-wing Christians. I mean, hell with those people. That's not what parapolitics is about. It's not really what – and I eschew the whole idea of conspiracy theory. You know, my motto is all conspiracy, no theory.
And, you know, this is just an amazing book. I mean, again, some of the things I read and I kind of arched my eyebrow and said, well, I'm not quite sure I buy that. But it does make you think. And then there were other things like, wow, I never looked at it that way. That makes some sense. That's worthy of more investigation.
Yeah, that's right. Like I said, it's you'll find in this book, actually, are kind of it's only 300 pages or so. But you will find more information there to guide you, to circumnavigate you through the data field of recent history and history to come in the 21st century, you'll find more information in there, more stuff to chew on, whether you want to believe it or not. You have to really understand what it is before you can make that reach that conclusion. That's kind of part of the reason why we put the book out at this time, is because we're like turning a page, right? We're entering in the Obama presidency, right? And also during a presidential election, people's paranoia always kind of goes up, and the Bush years are over and we're ready to move forward. And that's why the subtitle of the book is Banned Ideas and Hidden History into the 21st Century. It's kind of carrying on this whole if you want to call it a tradition, but a whole kind of orientation that people like Mae Brussel and Robert Anton Wilson and all the writers in this book have tried to put forward, just really to question authority and to think for yourself. That's the whole impulse of the book.
Well, we've been having such a good time, I forgot to take my break, so I think we're going to do that right now, and we'll be back with more with Ken Thomas on the Paranormal Podcast right after this. For everybody that is hearing the sound of my voice after this show is over, do me a favor. If you're listening from your computer, go right to your favorite email program after this show and email one person you know who loves the paranormal like you do and tell them about the Paranormal Podcast. Include a link to paranormalpodcast.com. If you're listening on the go in your car, jogging with your iPod, do me another favor. Next time you get to a computer, open up your email program, email one friend about the Paranormal Podcast. It would help us greatly, and we'd really appreciate it. We're trying to get those numbers up, and they've increased 50% in October. So with your help, we can even go further. Now back to the show. Well, welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast. We are having a very interesting time tonight with Ken Thomas. He is the co-editor of the new release, Secret and Suppressed 2, Banned Ideas and Hidden History into the 21st Century. He's edited that with Adam Parfrey, and that is from Farrell House. Ken, the last story that I'm going to mention, and I strongly suggest that people pick up the book themselves and read it because, there's a ton of data here. I must say, sometimes we'll get books and we, for the most part, always enjoy them. But a lot of times you get a lot of double spaced, 150 pages, that kind of thing. This is almost 300 pages of single spaced hardcore data. So it's very compact and very compressed. There's a lot of information here. But just to whet the appetite of our audience, we were all familiar with the financial crisis. Now, we all know, of course, the price of gas is now going down, but I think that that's probably a short-term thing, and we all agree that it's going to go up over time. And there's a story by Jay Wiedner called The Culling, a speculative look into the global apocalypse. And basically, his thesis is that the world's been made dependent on cheap oil intentionally by higher forces out there, and that there's an intentional, move afoot by the powers that be to shut off the spigot, plunging the world into kind of a forced population culling. Pretty chilling stuff.
Yeah, it certainly is. It is probably, I guess that's why we ended the book on it. It's probably the darkest chapter that we that we have in there. But, on the other hand, you have to consider that the Iraq war, that, speaking of darkness, that we've been going through these last several years, is all kind of fought right there at that spigot. I mean, that's one-fourth of the world's oil comes out of that area. The world economy is kind of built on that. So that war is kind of the realization of Wiedner's fears. And if everything that is said about peak oil is true, then, what a tremendous waste of resources. And how can that be? And how can that be on this planet that we're wasting our resources on something that is just not going to be there in the future? We can't, this can't be something that we all agree upon. This has to be the product of kind of short-sighted elites who are kind of exploiting the situation for their own power and greed. I think that's the leading point. He begins and he ends the whole thing with actually one of my favorite little dark little tunes, a song called The Future by Leonard Cohen, who's like a great mm-hmm. songwriter, that has the refrain, "I've seen the future and it is murder."
Well, it's certainly been the past of human history, so let's hope we're headed for maybe a better future. Speaking of the future, what's in the future for Ken Thomas in your work into the parapolitical and conspiracy theory?
Yeah, well, I should tell your listeners that in order to keep up with what I'm doing, and it's still changing all the time, you can go to my website, which is steamshovelpress.com. I do this semi-regular magazine called Steam Shovel Press. You can find out what's all that's about. And, you know, we've got the DVDs and my TV appearances and stuff available through steamshovelpress.com. But right now, really, I expect the next thing I'm going to do is a new edition of a book that was originally published again by Ron Bond, the guy we were talking about earlier, called Maury Island UFO. And it involves people that were witnesses to this UFO event in Maury Island, which is near Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest in the state of Washington, in 1947, actually days before Kenneth Arnold's famous sighting that started the whole post-war wave, who were subpoenaed later in 1968 by Jim Garrison as part of Garrison's investigation into the JFK assassination.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a leap.
Yeah, so this is a book, actually, that came out again in the 90s. That is, you know, it's impossible to find now. If you try to find it on Amazon, it'll cost you $75 to $100 just to track down a copy.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. That actually happened with the octopus, too, for a while. Then we came out with a second edition, and it became more available. These people, Fred Crisman is the assassin guy, and he was a central part of Jim Garrison's investigation, even though, you know, even if you watch Oliver Stone's movie, which is about Garrison's case, Crisman isn't mentioned at all. And these are guys who are connected to the covert world and also to the UFO subculture through decades. In fact, the book came out as a prequel to The Octopus, because one of the people connected to Crisman was an informer to Danny Casolaro, the writer guy who died. That was formed the basis of The Octopus. So this has been like the whole thrust of most of my particular research, is to kind of track over generations this kind of interconnected, you know, science fiction nightmare culture that intertwines covert manipulations and assassinations with advanced weaponry and UFOs and the whole alien presence nightmare, all that kind of stuff. So that's going to be coming out from Feral House 2. That'll be the next thing I have out. And long term, I was the last person to do a Freedom of Information Act search on Wilhelm Reich, and I have his prison correspondence, and I'd like to turn that into a volume. So looking for a publisher like that for that. And again, I got the magazine on a regular basis, and steamshovelpress.com, place where you can get a hold of me.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Now,
I'm
people
also on the
want
road
to get
a lot. Too.
Go ahead.
You know, I do lectures and stuff. I don't really right now. My calendar is just beginning to put down things to, you know, for lectures and conferences, UFO conferences, conspiracy conferences, and that kind of thing. So I meet with a lot of people that way. So you know, steamshovelpress.com. You can find out the next place I'm going to be.
And what we'll do, and your contact details are there, I assume, correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, what we'll do is on paranormalpodcast.com, we'll put a link to your site and also a link to Secret and Suppressed 2. I just checked. It is on Amazon. And I know you can get it in other sites as well.
If you could link to Feral House. Feral House.
Oh, sure.
You know, Adam Parfrey is actually one of the great publishers of the 20th and 21st century. He publishes all kinds of very interesting books and topics that are just not touched by many others. So the last edition of The Octopus is there, Secret and Suppressed is there, and his whole catalog at feralhouse.com. Good place to get it.
We will make it so. Well, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again when your new book comes out.
Oh, I'd be happy to, Jim. It's been great fun.
Okay, and thank you so much for listening to the Paranormal Podcast. Happy Halloween to everybody. I hope you've enjoyed the last month of increased output, and we're going to keep putting out shows on a regular basis and hope you continue to enjoy them. Until next time, I'm Jim Harreld. This is the Paranormal Podcast. Good night.